Good afternoon. I'd like to call the first meeting of House Hess together. It is approximately 3:05. And let the record reflect that Vice Chair Vasquez, Representative Tarr, Representative Talarico, and Representative Wool are present, as well as myself, Chair Seaton. I'd like to remind everybody to turn off their cell phones at this time, or at least silence them. And also wanted to remind anybody that's asking questions to address their questions through the chair. I'd like to introduce my committee aide, Tanika Hansen. So if anybody has any note to pass to staffers, or if staffers have any notes they want to pass to their representatives, if they would just come forward up here by the chair, Tanika will see you and she'll come get the message. And if anybody needs anything during the meeting, just ask for an at ease, and we'll take an at ease to get everything going. And let the record reflect that Representative Foster has joined us, and Representative Stutz was running a little behind, so she is not here yet. So what I would like to do is give a little opportunity for all of the members to introduce themselves and express what their particular interest is in the House Hess Committee. And Representative Vasquez, would you like to start, or we can start on the far end? Yeah. Representative Tarr.
Yeah. Representative Garen Tarr from Anchorage, and this is my second term serving on the Hess Committee. I'm very interested in vitamin D. Okay, good. Looking for a reaction from our chair. But very interested in improving health outcomes. Looking forward to working with the new commissioner and other key members of your staff on that. A lot of the bills I work on seem to end up in this committee, so it's personal interest, mental health, substance abuse treatment, child sexual abuse prevention. Those are some of my priorities. So I'm hoping we'll work on some of those, and looking forward to working with everyone here.
Representative Vasquez.
I'm Representative Liz Vasquez. I have a passion for healthcare. I have an MBA in Healthcare Services Administration. I served several years in the Commissioner's Office doing Quality Assurance Program Integrity, and I was the supervisor of the Office of Hearings and Appeals within HESS, Health and Social Services. So look forward to working with everyone to improve outcomes, and I'm big on prevention. I do take vitamin D and vitamin C every day, and I don't get sick. So anyway, I think we're gonna enjoy this committee.
Thank you, Representative Wool.
Hi, my name's Adam Wool from Fairbanks. First time in Juneau. First time on a health committee. I am very interested in health. My family, both my parents, my sisters, my nieces, my brother-in-law are all in the health industry in one form or another, both in direct care and nursing or physicians or in public health policy. I'm a consumer of healthcare. Like most people, I've had trouble getting access to healthcare and getting access to insurance as well, so I'm deeply concerned about those issues, and looking forward to working with people on the committee to make sure Alaskans stay healthier and have access to health care.
Representative Foster.
I don't want to capitalize too much on the vitamin D, but I have to say what my successes have been. I typically in the past have gotten colds 4 or 5 times a year. I've had an entire stretch of a year, no colds, nothing, taking vitamin D. So I am interested in learning more about it, but I am a believer. On top of that, I think my interest is the villages, and you look at how much, soda and energy drinks, I think not just in the villages, but across the state, and what the effects are on the kids, and so I think that's an area that I'm interested in maybe us exploring more. So.
Well, thank you. And Representative Talarico.
Hi, I'm Dave Talarico. I represent House District 6, which goes from Cantwell to Tanana to Arctic Village, over to Central, down to Border City, down to Kenny Lake. I'm sure you've all visited each and every one of those communities. There's about 43 distinct communities out there and a lot of remote communities. And I do have an interest in the delivery of healthcare services out in the remote communities and particularly an interest in telemedicine to see where we might be able to take that at some point in time.
Thank you. And I am Representative Paul Seaton. I'm from Homer. I represent the Southern Kenai Peninsula, which is small communities as well as I think it's the 14th largest community in Alaska, which is Homer. And my interest in HESS is that I see our state having had a very expensive healthcare system but not good outcomes. And we've got a budget that has been for years high and problematic as far as outcomes. And so what I want to do is make sure that we're looking at improving the health of Alaskans. And I think that if we improve the health status of Alaskans, therefore the fallout of that is not only healthier Alaskans and safer communities, but it's also the big impact on the budget, whether that's school budgets, whether that's our state budget, or whether that's private industry budgets, as far as the costs of health care. And so those will be my focus this year, although the department that we're looking at has a myriad of responsibilities and, you know, everything from children and children in need of aid, health care delivery in all parts of the state. So we have two things. One is the basic health and how do we improve the health so that we don't have to provide as much health care. And I think that if we, my focus will be on looking at that all the time, and that is upstream, what changes can we make upstream instead of waiting until we're downstream and we're treating diseases and expensive conditions. So prevention is the mantra that we'll be using in here, and there's many ways that we can be looking at that. So I look forward to this committee, and Representative Stutes, we've gone around and introduced everybody and why they wanted to serve or what their expectations of the committee, so I'll leave it up to you to fill in there as well as recognizing that you're here.
Thank you. I'm Louise Stutes. I'm from Kodiak. I represent not only Kodiak, but Cordova, Yakutat, Tyonek, Tetitlik, and I'm here because I'm going to learn about how to keep Alaskans healthy, and I want to participate in keeping Alaskans healthy.
Well, thanks all of the committee for introducing themselves to the state, and I wanted to recognize that Butch Garber is our secretary. And the LIO moderators are Thatcher Brower and Jessica Hanlon. So thank you for all the service that you provide for the committee. So today we're going to be hearing from the Department of Health and Social Services, and I would like to ask the commissioner and Jay Butler, or the chief medical officer, to come up. And we'll let you introduce your fellow department people. But I just want to, the commissioner designee, Valerie Davidson, and we're just going to refer to you as commissioner instead of commissioner designee from now on, just for convenience. Dr. Butler, welcome as well, and he's our chief medical officer. And so today is a day for you to tell us your vision and some of the options you have for hopefully accomplishing the goals that you've heard up here, and that is making Alaskans' healthcare or health status better and therefore improving healthcare.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, and before we start and you introduce your folks, you have a presentation. Would you like to go through that presentation and then come back for questions, or would you like to have questions as we go through the presentation?
We can do questions as we go through. That's fine.
Okay, well, thank you. And would you go ahead and would you like to introduce any members of your department that you have with you?
Sure. I'll actually be doing that throughout my presentation, if that's okay.
That's fine.
So, Koyana, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to be my very to listen to the Department of Health and Social Services priorities. And this is actually my very first public testimony as Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, and I really appreciate the opportunity that it is here. Before we do more of it, it's nice to have a committee that I'm a little bit familiar with. Let me tell you a little bit about me. I was born in Bethel and raised in Aniak, definitely a village girl. My mother's family is from Guiginluk on the coast near Bethel. My father's family is from Port Orchard, Washington, in the fine Yupik tradition. When a young man and young woman meet and fall in love and marry, he uproots himself and moves to his wife's home village. So I was born and raised in Bethel and Aniak. When I was in junior high and high school, though, my dad's job changed, and so I moved. The whole family moved and went to junior high and high school at Eielson Air Force Base, which you can imagine was quite a change. So for the last, my background is I'm actually an early childhood teacher in a former life. I'm a Head Start kid, a strong believer in early childhood opportunities. I think that often we've seen it in other experiences that the sooner we can have good relationships with healthcare providers and young children, we really set them off for great experiences later in life. For the last 15 years, I've worked in the Alaska Tribal Health System. For 7 years at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, located in Bethel. I want to give my thanks and appreciation to them. And they are incredibly innovative, providing healthcare services in a region about the size of the state of Oregon with no roads connecting any communities. And when you have those kind of challenges, or perhaps some of the budget challenges that we are seeing today, certainly gives you an opportunity to be a lot more innovative. So it's nice to have that experience as well. Most recently, for the last 8 years, I've worked at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a statewide tribal health organization. And so now I am the commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, or rather the commissioner designee until we're able to do the confirmation, which I believe is in April. I did want to introduce Dr. Jay Butler, who's our chief medical officer and division director. Jay is one of the folks that I stole away from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. He's not new to state service, previously served as both director of public health, but was also chief medical officer prior. Lots of experience at the Centers for Disease Control. And I'll maybe let him talk a little bit more about introduce himself. So I did want to give you a little bit of an overview of the department. I realize that we do have some new members, and I wanted to make sure that you had a chance to meet some of our core team. I mentioned Dr. Jay Butler. I also wanted to introduce the Deputy Commissioner for Medicaid and Healthcare Policy, John Sherwood, who's in the audience today, if John wouldn't mind standing and waving. John, many of you may have met John before in the past. Probably the person in the department who is most knowledgeable about Medicaid. Worked with him for about 15 years in other capacities. He most recently was in the Senior and Disability Services Division. I also wanted to introduce Deputy Commissioner for Family, Community, and Integrated Services, Reese Sailors. And she oversees Children's Services, Juvenile Justice, and Behavioral Health. And then finally, I wanted to introduce Sana Eford, who is the Assistant Commissioner for Finance and Management Services. We've been spending a lot of time together prepping for our House Finance HES Subcommittee presentations, which will start next week.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Tarr.
Thank you. Commissioner Davidson, could you just help me understand, in what ways was the department reorganized or have positions changed just to up a line from last year to now?
Oh, sure. I'm sorry. So far, I've been in the job about 6 weeks, maybe seven, almost 7 weeks. So the only difference that we have is behavioral health was previously under the commissioner, the deputy commissioner for Medicaid and health care policy, mm-hmm. and now behavioral health has swapped with the Division of Public Assistance. So if you think about it, the family, community, and integrated services, mm-hmm. children's services, juvenile justice, and behavioral health really fit together nicely if we want to focus on prevention opportunities mm-hmm. That will prevent children from being in state custody either through the juvenile justice system or an out-of-home placements with the Office of Children's Services.
Thank you.
Thank you. We also have a couple of other folks who are relatively new to our, well, actually very new to our team. I want to introduce our healthcare policy advisor, Monique Martin. And Monique, I also stole away from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Mm-hmm. Monique and I worked together for about 5 years. And Monique probably knows more than a whole bunch of people about the Affordable Care Act opportunities. She's actually a certified navigator. Clearly, she won't have time to provide those services in her new role at the department, but was also my right-hand person on Medicaid expansion at the consortium. So I'm happy that she was able to step up and be able to agree to be in this new role. I also want to introduce someone that we begged to come out of retirement, Chris Ashenbrenner, our Medicaid expansion project director. And Chris has worked in the department. She retired after about 30 years of service. Was also worked in public assistance, worked throughout the department, but also worked in public assistance at the time that welfare reform was being implemented in our state. So has a lot of experience in implementing a program that really is a brand new program and a significant heavy lift. What I also appreciate about her is that she also is a former fisherman and knows what it's like to go without health insurance. Tony Newman is our legislative liaison, and Tony is not new to the department. Many of you may be familiar with Tony. He provided legislative liaison services previously in the Division of Juvenile Justice and has agreed to now be the department's legislative liaison. I also wanted to introduce, well, she's not here, Tara Horton, special assistant. She's actually in Anchorage, helps me make sure that I'm pointed in the right direction. I'm sorry, I should have also introduced Wilda Laughlin. Wilda is, many of you know Wilda from before. She definitely keeps us pointed in the right direction in terms of providing information to the legislature. As you can imagine, we get a lot of requests and want to make sure that as you ask for fiscal notes and analysis and or for technical assistance that we're able to provide that. And Tony and Wilda definitely work as a team to be able to make sure that you have what you need and that we as a state have what we need. So within the department, there are actually 8 divisions. The Alaska Pioneer Homes, Vicki Wilson is the acting director, and the Pioneer Homes, their mission is to provide the highest quality of life in a safe home environment for older Alaskans and veterans. There are a number of facilities throughout the state. Al Wall is our director of behavioral health, and their role is to manage an integrated and comprehensive behavioral health system. We actually used to in the state have a mental health system and an alcohol and substance abuse system. And now, of course, as we realize that so many people have co-occurring conditions, it really makes sense to be able to integrate that now. We want to make sure that it's based, of course, on sound policy, effective practices, and partnerships. The Office of Children's Services, our director is Christy Lawton. She continues in that role. And their role is to prevent and respond to child maltreatment in order to ensure safe children and strong families. Margaret Brody continues as the Director of Healthcare Services to manage healthcare coverage for Alaskans in need. The Division of Juvenile Justice, Karen Forrest, continues in that role. And not only do they hold juvenile offenders accountable for their behavior, they also really promote the safe restoration of victims and communities. And also, because these are juveniles, are really helping them to learn and their families learn to develop skills to be able to prevent crime and to be able to prevent the cycle of going back through juvenile justice. And they have really done an incredible job of reducing recidivism. Division of Public Assistance, Ron Creer, has come back to be acting director. And in a nutshell, the public assistance does everything to ensure that we can enroll people in families, children and families, for programs that they are eligible for. Division of Public Health, I think you'll hear from Jay in a moment about what he does. I don't want to steal his thunder, but you know, clearly public health protects and promotes the health of Alaskans in a variety of ways. I'm not going to get into that. Dwayne Mays continues as the Director of Senior and Disability Services, and our goal there is to make sure that we promote the independence of Alaskans, seniors, as well as folks who experience disabling conditions from being able to live safely in the community.
And Commissioner, Senior and Disability Services and Division of Public Assistance, now the public assistance that seniors receive, is that coming through that department or is that separate?
All of the public assistance programs, whether they're for seniors or for their or if they're for children or adults, come through the Division of Public Assistance.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I should have said, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry. So some of this is not new to you in terms of our vision for the department. Is we really want to see Alaska individuals, families, and communities really are safe and they're as healthy as possible. And so we have a number of priorities in the department. There are three main priorities. Health and wellness across the lifespan is the first one. Healthcare access, delivery, and value, the second one. And of course, safe and responsible individual families and communities. So a huge focus, lots of main priorities, but there are also some core services that we provide. As we go through, I know that in our budget hearings next week, we do do results-based accountability budgeting. And so you can see how those services link to the budget. I didn't want to get into a lot of the budget today because I think this is really an overview of the department. But I do have to give kudos to the previous commissioner who really did a good job of making sure that those budgets aligned with the priorities for the department. And just so you know, that was not an easy thing to do. It took about 3 years to get where we are, and we're probably not where we need to be. We're just starting to get that data now.
And Commissioner, within those priorities, do we yet have plans on how to accomplish those, improve the health status of Alaskans? I mean, we have a lot of goals, and of course, this committee isn't going to be the budget finance subcommittee. So what we're really looking at and wanting to develop is what plans are we going to implement to get there? And I'm not asking you to have all of the answers today, but that's a core question from us, whether it's on that priority or the healthcare access and the safe and responsible individuals, families, and communities. So I guess as we develop this further, you're new on the job, but we want to make sure that we have a mechanism to accomplish each one of those goals, or that some way we are proposing to change, because where we are right now is not an enviable position, you know, in the ranking of the United States, much less what we need for Alaskans. So as we go forward, you know, that's where I want to concentrate and find out, okay, what do we need to do to develop the plan to implement or accomplish that goal and put us on the path.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in that, that's a great question, and of course we can't accomplish all of those things. So one of the things that we've done immediately is to look at what are the four primary focus areas that we can look at that we would like to make priorities to be able to achieve those things, and we've identified four. The first is providing access to healthcare for Alaskans, and we see a couple of ways to be able to do that. I think it has been no surprise that Governor Walker is, and this administration is committed to Medicaid expansion. We have over 40,000 Alaskans who right now don't or eligible for would be eligible for Medicaid expansion, and we anticipate that they would be enrolled in Medicaid expansion. These are folks right now who don't have access to health care. But we really see a couple of things happening. One is, in the short term, we want to get people as healthy as possible, especially in those last couple of years that we have remaining for 100% federal match. But a longer term goal is we also recognize that we have to make some major changes to our Medicaid program to make sure that we can deliver that program as efficiently as possible, no matter who is paying the bill. So for both regular Medicaid program, people who are currently enrolled in Medicaid, and also for the expanded population. Now, with Medicaid expansion, we do have, I'll be honest, we have some pretty significant systems challenges. They shouldn't be a surprise because we know that we are having challenges enrolling individuals in Medicaid right now. The department was undergoing two major systems conversions. One was the eligibility system conversion from EIS, the Eligibility Information System, to a new system called ARES. And it does more than just eligibility for Medicaid. It also does eligibility for other kinds of public assistance programs. And we have some backlogs there. The program was supposed to go live for the Medicaid eligibility determination in October of 2013. That didn't actually happen until October 2014. So we're working on the backlog. We're making sure that we're implementing some things that will allow us to be able to get caught up. On the other hand, the department was also implementing a major systems change to the payment system called MMIS, or the Medicaid, it's a Medicaid payment system, Medicaid Management Information System. And we have had significant challenges. Our contractor is Xerox there. And we have had challenges with both accuracy of claims payments for providers as well as timely payments for providers. And so what we know is that we want to be really responsible about how we implement Medicaid expansion. So before we bring on new folks to enrollment and also new folks who are going to receive services, and providers are going to need payment for those services that they have agreed to provide on our behalf, we have to proceed responsibly, which means those systems have to be running sufficiently for us to be able to be ready for expansion. And right now, based upon what we know today, we anticipate a July start date for Medicaid expansion. But you should also know that we're going to be pushing pretty hard and pretty aggressively to meet that goal.
Representative Stutes and then Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does your department now, or do you anticipate working with the Department of Corrections? It appears to me that we have a lot of people in our jail system that don't need to be in the jail system. They need to have some mental health evaluation, and there seems to be a real disconnect between the Department of Corrections or our court system and the Department of Social and Health Services. And I think that if there were some kind of transportation with information back and forth, it could certainly alleviate the burden on our on our penal system and help quite a few of our Alaskans at the same time.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, you're exactly right. I mean, one of the things that we know is that early intervention opportunities really are the key to help us to not have to build yet another prison. I know that there is a recidivism effort happening right now, both with the Department of Corrections, the Department of Health and Social Services is involved, the court system is involved, local communities are involved, to make sure that, you know, if we have a, if our prisons or our correction systems are filled with people who wouldn't be there if we provided adequate alcohol or other substance abuse treatment, then those are resources that are very well spent. Hence the opportunity with Medicaid expansion. Under Medicaid expansion, behavioral health services are covered. And in fact, we're required by federal law to have behavioral health parity under the Affordable Care Act. So we do see those opportunities to be able to interrupt that cycle of not only in corrections, but also in child welfare issues. Those challenges are cyclical. And I think sometimes when we focus too late, we focus when they're in corrections or when we focus on child welfare issues, when kids are already alerted, when they're already in our system in one way or the other, then we've really started too late. And so where can we intervene sooner to be able to stop that cycle and prevent that from happening in the first place? Which brings me to one of the points under Medicaid expansion is, I'm not going to get into the details right now on numbers. We're still refining those, but we do know that we will see some savings from corrections contract when a corrections individual is seen out of the facility. They're not eligible for Medicaid when they're in the facility if they're an inmate. But if they have to be seen outside of the facility and they are no longer in-house, then the state of Alaska right now pays significant general fund dollars for those corrections health care costs. And those are costs that could be covered through Medicaid expansion. So the challenge, though, is an issue of timing. We have to make sure that we can get folks enrolled and we have enough time for them to be able to be enrolled and receiving services before we say, okay, we're going to be able to completely eliminate that cost. Under the Medicaid rules, there are timely filing rules, which actually are a year long. And so it will take some time for that to be able to clean up. So we have estimated that very conservatively in terms of savings for the first year, but we will see that as Medicaid expansion rolls out. Now, that said, there are some short-term gains that we know, not only in corrections, but also in the catastrophic coverage that right now the general fund currently pays for folks who are not eligible for Medicaid but do have their health care paid for under the catastrophic fund, that we also will anticipate seeing savings. But in terms of a longer-term strategy, we know that that Medicaid, our department's budget is about $2.7 billion, and Medicaid makes up $1.7 billion of that budget. And we believe that we need to take a hard look at how do we utilize Medicaid services in our state. Can we do things differently? Can we look to other states for models of how they're doing that to design an Alaska program that actually works for Alaska? So some of the things that we're thinking about are, you know, there are opportunities right now that exist that will allow us to be able to realize savings. I'm going to give you one example. There are more. The legislature for the last several years has been working on funding projects for long-term care facilities, skilled nursing facilities. We have facilities now in Bethel, in Kotzebue, and in Nome. That is a great benefit for the state in a couple of ways. One is it provides care to individual Alaskans as close to home as possible so that those elders don't have to be moved into Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau for services. They get to be closer to home with their families. But the other benefit for the state is if three things come together, the state actually receives 100% match for those services. Those three things are if you're an IHS beneficiary, Indian Health Service beneficiary, you're Alaska Native or American Indian, if you are also a Medicaid beneficiary and you are seen in an IHS or Indian Health Service facility in our state, tribally operated facilities, those are 100% federal match. And that's true before Medicaid expansion, that's true during Medicaid expansion, and that's also true after Medicaid expansion. A few years ago, the legislature, in their wisdom, passed a bill called Senate Bill 61 that really looked at what are the best opportunities for our state to be able to leverage opportunities and partnerships with the tribal health system to realize savings, and they focused on two areas. The first, I mentioned already, is in long-term care services, not only in residential services, but also in home and community-based services. And the other was in the area of behavioral health. So those are some of the things that we're looking at. But I want you to know that those things, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, our federal counterparts, that will have to be negotiated not only with CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but also with our tribal partners, and obviously the state needs to be at the table to make sure that we're developing a program that's appropriate for Alaska. But we have other opportunities as well. So there are things that we're doing right now. For example, a program that is called a super utilizer program, probably not the best term, but we do have some Medicaid enrollees who are utilizing the emergency department probably more than they should. And so we are working with them to manage their care so that they can receive their care in a more appropriate environment, for example, with a primary care provider. One of the things that we know that we're going to have to work on is that, we all are creatures of habit, that includes me, and that if you're a person who has been without health insurance for pretty much your entire life, you know that the one place that you can go for health care is the emergency room, because the emergency room cannot legally turn you away because of the federal law EMTALA, where they're required to screen you and to stabilize you before sending you on your way. And so people have learned that if you don't have coverage, you can go to a hospital because a hospital is required legally to provide at least some level of health care. What that has meant, though, for our hospitals is that they have a significant uncompensated care or charity care that they carry on their books every year. That one of the benefits of Medicaid expansion, and of course those costs get spread out to everybody. If you operate as a business and you provide a donation, you have to make up those expenses elsewhere. So that will help the entire state to be able to help with those, to spread that cost. But also, we need to make sure that we work with individuals to make sure that they know how to access health care in more appropriate ways. One last thought on Medicaid reform is I've been asked a lot, well, when you say Medicaid expansion is a catalyst for meaningful Medicaid reform, what does that mean? The truth is we're open to ideas. I mean, we have some of our ideas of our own that I have just mentioned, but we also want to look to the experiences of other states. What are other states doing that can serve as models for our state? Given the uniqueness of our state and how the size of our population and the fact that we are really spread out in terms of geography, I think we're not going to be able to pick up an example from another state and drop it here in Alaska and expect it to work. So we're going to really have to spend some time over the next year crafting a solution that actually works for Alaskans. But we're open to ideas. We'll be working with the provider community. We're certainly interested in working with the legislature on ideas that you may have to be able to accomplish that. And the truth is, we're also looking to other states for best practices. But we also have to do it responsibly, and we want to make sure that we take the time to do that right. And somebody asked me, well, have you figured out your Medicaid reform strategy yet? And I said, well, unfortunately, not yet. I think that's a lot to ask anyone to do in 6 weeks. I can work really hard, but I also want to make sure that we get it right, because we have the opportunity to do the right thing for Alaskans and for the Alaska budget, but we have to take the time to do that appropriately.
Before you go on, Representative Foster had a question.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. We hear that the first couple of years, health care is 100% paid for by the feds. I'm just curious, in the transition, are there costs that the state will have to pick up to get to the point where we can be reimbursed 100%, or do we get reimbursed for the transition costs later as well?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Foster, the way that Medicaid expansion works is, I'm going to talk a little bit broadly and then I'll answer your question more specifically. Under the Affordable Care Act, through Medicaid expansion allows states to be reimbursed at 100% federal match for the first three hard calendar years, and those are calendar years 2014, 2015, and 2016. And I want to be clear, those aren't rolling years. So we've already missed the first year of 100% federal match opportunity. And for the next three calendar years, 2017, 2018, and 2019, the federal match transitions from 95% federal match to 93% federal match. So it goes 95, 94, 93. And then starting in 2020, the match transitions to 90% federal match. And it remains thereafter. Now, so in terms of the administrative costs that it takes for us to be able to be up and running, in addition to the Medicaid expansion opportunities under regular Medicaid, we also have an administrative match when we administer the Medicaid program. The federal government reimburses us for 50% of that cost as well. For systems improvements, though, for computer systems, et cetera, we also have the benefit of 90% match for systems changes that we're implementing. So we do have opportunities there for offset as well.
Just a quick follow-up. I know that you don't have numbers right now. But you're going to be bringing those to the subcommittee for health. But just curious if maybe we can get copies of that when you do. And just off the top of your head, do you know if that's a big number or a small number of the transition in terms of personnel and software and so forth?
I think the governor is going to be releasing his state of the he's going to be providing the state of the budget on Thursday, and I know we'll be releasing the budget thereafter. I certainly don't want to get in front of the governor and provide you with detail that I'm not yet able to provide. I think that that the number is it's a reasonable number. I think it may be smaller than what folks have been anticipating. And even that, I've probably said more than I should. I think I might be getting myself in trouble here. So why don't I move on, if that's okay?
Well, I want to stay with this slide for a minute, because you had another acronym there about enrolling individuals, and this is a new committee. We're not familiar with that. So if you could let us know that and how it's evolved, and has that been as problematic as the Medicaid, the Xerox contract, and are we better off, you know, where in a little more detail are we in the enrollment new system?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, as I said before, we do have an enrollment system upgrade happening right now, or actually a whole conversion. The old system is about 28 years old. And I'll be honest that right now they're having to work in both systems. Phase one of the conversion, which is just the Medicaid determinations, were delayed a year. Phase two will do the other, will go live for the other public assistance, including TANF, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, food assistance programs, and other public assistance programs won't go live until later. But we do have some backlogs. We are undertaking efforts, including right now we have voluntary overtime. I think we're about to implement mandatory overtime requirements to make sure that individuals can get enrolled to be able to make sure that we can meet those backlogs. Now, in terms of the comparison between the enrollment system and the payment system, I think we have made more progress on the enrollment system. With the payment system, you may know or may have heard that we are actually, the prior administration started litigation against Xerox. So in my mind, that tells me that if there's litigation, that things have definitely reached a point where there's a problem. So where we are with the litigation is we're required under the contract to do an administrative hearing first that will be heard before an administrative law judge in February. We also are gearing up for that. We have also hired an independent consultant to come and look at Xerox's work, to look at the programming, and to give us an independent evaluation of where we really are. Xerox has provided a performance improvement plan to us that we're reviewing. We're in very early stages, but again, I think having that independent assessment from a third party will really give us a better sense of where we are. I think the challenge we have is that providers, I just want to be really honest that the situation is more dire than we thought it was, certainly more than I thought it was on December 1st when I came in. We are going to be undertaking an effort to be more transparent about the state of those systems. We're going to be putting information on our website shortly to give the public some information and be transparent about where we are, both in terms of the backlog as well as our opportunities for improvement. Because I think, quite frankly, the public deserves to know where we are. I expect that once that comes out, I expect to take a beating or two from the public, but I think that unless we acknowledge where we are, we're not going to be able to really own the problem and we're not going to be in a position to fix it. So. You have our commitment for transparency, and we think that will go a long way in not only giving the public information that they need, but also holding us accountable to fixing those systems. Providers have been working with healthcare services on making sure that workarounds are in place to make sure that providers can get paid. Mm-hmm. It's not as fast as we would like, but we are implementing workarounds to make sure that providers who have stepped up to provide services on behalf of us as the state are getting paid.
Following up on that, I know last year I was very disappointed when we rolled out the program and we weren't keeping dual books. And, you know, my office called when we first had problems back to Massachusetts and found out, because they had used Xerox as well, and they had all these same problems. And they were getting a little better after a year. Do you know, or does anyone with your department know, if the problems have actually been solved in Massachusetts, I believe it was, that Xerox had originally rolled out their program in, or are they still having these same issues going forward?
Mr. Chairman, other states, as you mentioned, do have contracts with Xerox. There are some states that have seen improvements. I think the challenge that we have with our state and our system that Xerox has designed for us is that those other states are really managed care states, so they are not necessarily having to process as many claims or have the capability to be able to process as many claims as Alaska does. But we certainly are coordinating with other states in terms of they also, other states are also involved in litigation with Xerox, and there's definitely, we're looking out from the experiences of other states to make sure that as they make improvements that we have those same opportunities here. The challenge is the systems are really designed to do very different things in other states. So our other priority, if I may, sure. Would you, do you have another? Okay, all right. So our other, another, a particular passion of mine are child welfare issues and keeping Alaska's children safe. And we know that, unfortunately, right now, we have over 2,400 kids, Alaskan kids, who are in out-of-home placements. And we have never seen numbers that high. We are very concerned about making sure that we have the resources and can design programs that will prevent that from happening. And if I may turn to the next slide, I think this is going to be the key to get us there. And so another, the third area of focus is really enhancing our tribal and federal partnerships to be able to get us where we need to be. And as I was talking to somebody about that third priority, a person said to me, well, that seems more like a strategy, and to some degree it is. But we also know that given where we have been as a state, we know that we have to have this one out there front and center to be able to enhance relationships and partnerships with tribal organizations and with the federal government, the Administration for Children and Families, the Department of Interior, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, to make sure that we can remove barriers that are really standing in the way of progress. I think that this is clearly an example where, unfortunately, when we do have fewer resources, we have to be a lot more creative about how we work together to address these issues. Right now, we have a significant disproportionality problem in our state. Alaska Native children comprise about 17% to 20% of our state's population, but unfortunately comprise about 60% of the children in out-of-home placements. And I think that what we have shown, what we have demonstrated as a state, is the state alone cannot solve this problem. I know that tribes and tribal organizations have also tried to solve that problem on their own. They have demonstrated that yes, they can make progress, but they also can't do it alone. The Administration for Children and Families can't do it alone. The Department of Interior can't do it alone, and neither can the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And so it has been long past time for us to be able to sit down at the table, to be able to talk about what each of us are doing. I think I'll be honest that maybe more honest than I should be, that we have had relationship challenges in the past, and I think we're also going to have to agree that we check our bags at the door and really change the focus, not necessarily on who's providing the services, but what are we doing right for kids, where do we want to be, and who's going to do what to help us to be able to get there. I know that Christy Lawton has been working with tribal organizations through the State Tribal Collaborative Work Group on opportunities to be able to move forward. But I think that is, we're going to have to be a lot more aggressive about leveraging those partnerships and opportunities. And the truth is, tribal organizations have been really ready for that for a long time. And the truth is, we do have, I think all of us have our own ideas of how things need to be done, and I think our commitment to children should be stronger than what our ideas of the right solution should be. And so we're gonna do a lot of that. So, but I want you to know that is, it's gonna take some time to build those partnerships, and building trust is something that happens over time. The good news is that we do have good relationships in each of those areas, just from past work experience. I recently served on the U.S. Department of Justice's Advisory Committee on American Indian and Alaska Native Children Exposed to Violence. Representatives from the Department of Interior also came to those meetings. So did representatives of the Department of Health and Human Services. Tribes were present, and we're really looking forward to being able to move on some of those recommendations to be able to tackle this issue for Alaska.
And do you see particular barriers that the legislature is going to have to work on in this partnership, or is that an more of an administrative tribal partnership process?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's going to be a little bit of both. So there are things that, for example, we have some agreements, for example, with Tanana Chiefs Conference to be able to do a better state-tribal partnership, but I think we're having challenges getting them information, and there's a question of whether we can provide them with information about child welfare cases. And so there are some things that are going to be just a matter of administrative discretion that we think that we can do things differently. Our governor has committed to working across departments to be able to get those issues addressed. So we are in a really different environment now. But we think that this is also our opportunity to, if there are statutes that aren't entirely clear, we want to make sure that we are clear about what those opportunities are to removing those barriers, so that if we do have a change in administration, that those statutes are in the books, so that that we can move forward and be absolutely clear. I can't identify exactly the specifics of what those are, but you'll definitely be hearing from us on what those are.
Sure, and we look forward to addressing those issues. So make sure you bring them forward early, and we can work on those to make sure that we get the right.
Okay. So. Brianna, thank you. So another area of primary focus is obviously, you know, improving the health status of Alaskans is really what we're all about. And I want to, at this point, turn over this part of the presentation to Dr. Butler, Chief Medical Officer and Director of Public Health.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chairman Seaton, members of the committee, if you don't mind, I'll start with a little bit of a personal introduction. I'm one of those people that the governor mentioned last night that chose Alaska. I was not born here. In fact, going back 20 years, I thought I was sort of living the dream after years of training, going through medical school and training as both internal medicine and pediatrics, and then subspecialty training in infectious diseases. I was working at the Centers for Disease Control 8 months out of the year, doing public health research, primarily in infectious diseases, and 4 months working in clinical infectious diseases at the Emory University System in Atlanta. My family's background is not in healthcare. In fact, it's somewhat ironic that I come from about 200 years of tobacco farmers. It's an interesting thing about my family is everybody quit smoking in the mid-1960s. The Surgeon General's report had really impressed my family, even those who continued to work in tobacco. Then one day I got a call from the secretary of the boss's boss's boss, and was asked would I be interested in considering a position with the unit in Alaska. I had never really thought about coming to Alaska, but sometimes you hear things and you just can't get it out of your head. So my wife and I visited. We accepted the position for a 1 to 2 year assignment, and I'm pleased to say that 1 to 2 years can turn into forever. I have Alaska as our home. Four of my five children call Alaska home. I'm sure the fifth one is going to come around before long. And I have two, soon to be three, grandchildren in Alaska as well. So it's an honor to be able to speak with you today. Past 5 years I've been with ANTHC. That also was a pleasant job, not only being a physician executive, but actually doing clinical work as well. I've had a little bit of a reverse culture shock coming back into government, but I think I can deal with that. So what I was hoping to do in a few minutes today was talk about some of the areas of primary focus for improving health status of Alaskans. And some of this is focusing on problems, and I'll say that up front. But just referring to the list here, one of the, and this is not in any particular priority list, but one of the issues that we've been dealing with as a state and as a nation over the past 15 to 20 years is preventing and controlling the complications of obesity. I think over the past couple of years, maybe we've begun to bend the trend a little bit, and the rates have stopped that steep increase. However, still we have 28% of Alaskan adults are obese, defined as a body mass index above 30, which is a rough estimation of fat content in the body, and 17% of children. I don't want to focus on that so much as some of the complications of obesity, which aren't necessarily tightly tied to the body mass index. Obesity is probably a primary driver, though, in the increased rates of diabetes. And for more than 10 years now, more than 1 in 20 Alaskans have type 2 diabetes. Back when I was doing my medical training, we called that adult onset diabetes. And in fact, if we saw a teenager with type 2 diabetes, which is the type associated with obesity, that was quite remarkable. It was quite rare. Unfortunately, in the past 15 years, the age group that's seen the biggest increase in obesity has been adolescents and young adults. So we don't use that term adult onset so much anymore. We do know that diabetes can be managed. We also know it can be prevented through healthy behaviors, and, which can include weight control and healthy diet. How do we influence healthy behaviors? Some of it is helping to make the healthy choice the easy choice. You know, it's not easy always to make those decisions, but if it's, for instance, if the choices between the elevator and the stairs, if the stairs are safe, if they're comfortable, if they're attractive, I think people will be more likely to actually use the stairs. And there's a tendency we all, you know, we may think of our bodies as a machine and all we have to do is take medicine to be healthy, but oftentimes it's more complicated than that. And the preventive maintenance includes what we put into our bodies in terms of diet as well as our activities. Education is also an important part of influencing behaviors, and I firmly believe that informed Alaskans are more likely to make healthy choices. I have to give a shout out to Healthy Futures, a program that we support in a large number of schools around the state. I've been a bit of a secret shopper on that program. They're active in my son's elementary school. So I've been interested to get his insights on what's going on. And just observing his behavior, I think, is enlightening. He and his younger brother snuck out of bed to go get a midnight snack, which was forbidden. But it was interesting. They didn't go in the kitchen. They went out to the garden and picked carrots. And so they were scolded for leaving the house in the middle of the night. But as my daughter said, it's hard to want to discipline them for choosing to eat carrots in the middle of the night. I think the power of education is profound. The holy grail of public health is disease eradication. That's really only happened once for human health with the eradication of smallpox which was done using really 19th century technology with one of the more crude vaccines, but through vaccination. We are on the verge of eradicating the second. 30 years ago, when I was working at a mission hospital in Kenya, I noticed how every examination room had a box of toothpicks, and we would use that to extract the guinea worms, these long worms that would come out through the skin, and we would roll them up gently over a period of hours to days to remove the worm. These worms are acquired from drinking the eggs in water. The reason the worm comes out of the skin is to be able to excrete its eggs when it senses water is nearby. At that time when I was in Kenya, there were literally hundreds of millions of cases of guinea worm that occurred every year. There has been extensive outreach, particularly in the involved areas in the equatorial zone of the world, which have included communities, tribal leaders, faith communities, of helping people understand how the disease is transmitted and how it can be prevented through very simple technology. Simple as drinking water through a straw that's filtered by a filter as simple as a T-shirt. So that may be a disease that we'll see gone before long. I think that is the power of education. Second point is reducing tobacco use. We have made progress in this area. We're as a state down to about 20% of Alaskans are using tobacco, although there's quite a bit of disparity. It's the rates are lower in some of our urban areas and much higher in northern and western Alaska. We've made huge progress with preventing smoking, and I think when we look at the demographics of smoking, it's remarkable that the majority are non-smokers now, and among those who have ever smoked, the majority are former smokers. So we are really making progress, and some of this is through education. Some of it is changing in what's considered normal. When I was growing up, even without smokers in my home, it was common that you had an ashtray for guests. And if they smoked, they came in your house, and they might say, "Do you mind if I smoke?" But they would line up. Our social norms of what's acceptable behavior with tobacco has changed. There are other areas where we might be able to do that as well, and I'll get to alcohol in just a moment. But tobacco is a big one in terms of an opportunity for preventing, probably the biggest single item that is an opportunity for preventing disease and disability.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you doing anything with the whole e-cigarette issue, or you know, are you just focusing, you know, on this tobacco use, traditional cigarette use for now? Just curious.
Well, the e-cigarette issue is one of great interest, and there is a lot that's still not known as well. Representative Seaton and I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Tarr. When we look at tobacco use, it overlaps quite a bit with the e-cigarette issue, which also then overlaps with the marijuana issue. And so a lot of the work that we do addresses two, sometimes three of those issues at once. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot that we still need to know about e-cigarettes. Mm-hmm. They have been touted as nicotine prevention tools. Mm-hmm. I would point out, though, that they are not currently FDA approved for that purpose, and we do have other tools for treating nicotine addiction. And I don't say addiction in any kind of pejorative way, but I think it's important to recognize that our brains have receptors for nicotine. And I think it was Mark Twain who said, "Quitting smoking is the easiest thing in the world. I've done it 100 times. there is a very specific hunger for nicotine. Mm-hmm. The other concern that I would have about e-cigarettes is the flavors, the marketing. It's a bit like some of the smokeless products. They don't have a tobacco taste. It's very minty, but they still deliver that nicotine punch.
Mm-hmm. Following up on that, has the department made it very clear to Alaskans that it's illegal under the law that we passed to provide nicotine to minors, whether that's through e-cigarettes or whatever. You know, we passed a law about 3 years ago. I was the sponsor of the bill because we had you couldn't give tobacco to kids, but there was nothing that was preventing nicotine delivery, and we had tobacco companies that were making breath strips that were soaked in and toothpicks and those kind of things that were laced with nicotine. And the obvious thing that's going to happen is people will become addicted to nicotine, and then when they're old enough, they're probably going to switch to tobacco and have all those because they have a addiction. So is the department making it clear throughout Alaska that giving, other than by a parent, but giving or selling nicotine products as well as tobacco products is illegal in our state?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question, because I think it's a very important one, because we know that many people who smoke for years start during their teenage years, and it's a real opportunity to intervene. And legislation like what you mentioned is a very important deterrent. I actually can't address offhand the enforcement side. I could get back with you on that. I certainly can say on the educational side, we talk about the illegal sale to minors.
And I don't know of tobacco or
tobacco products.
Yeah, see, and we passed the law that non-tobacco products that deliver nicotine are illegal in our state to give to minors, give or sell. And so some people have brought up e-cigarettes. Well, kids can do those, and, you know, we're trying to get out the news that if you do that, you're in violation of the law. You know, so establishments as well. No, but I haven't seen any advertisement, or I haven't seen any, and so I'm concerned. And so as you go forward, I hope that you put that into the educational packet so we prevent addiction before people are using.
Yeah, Mr. Tobacco. Chairman, your point's well taken. And I think it also highlights the point that one of the potential problems with e-cigarettes is it kind of normalizes the smoking behavior again. We also want to reduce abuse of alcohol as well as other drugs. This, of course, is a big issue. We oftentimes think in terms of the problems of the chronic inebriate, but also it's important to realize that about a quarter of Alaskan adults report binge drinking, which depends on your size and metabolism, but for somebody like me, it would be six drinks in a setting. And it's important to realize that it's not just a personal health decision, but that being impaired affects the health of others, including risks of injuries, particularly related to motor vehicles, and also risks to the fetus. And we have some real challenges with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. We haven't been spared from the national epidemic of opioid drug abuse either. There have been some states that have really begun to make a difference on that area by focusing on prescriptions as well as sales. I don't have a good explanation for why the rate per capita of opioid prescriptions nationally increased fourfold over about 20 years, other than I think physicians, and I'm pointing to myself here, don't have a lot of background in pain management. And that's an area where we need to make sure our providers are comfortable with managing pain, know how to do it. There's times when opioids are entirely appropriate, but a 30-day supply after a root canal, which is just not something that's probably necessary. This will be one of the priorities for the Alaska Healthcare Commission during the coming year, as well as continuing to address how we might reduce opioid use. And it is an,
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Representative Wall.
Yeah, is there talk of a database for people that get opioid prescriptions, a centralized database so that I can't go to several doctors, or an individual can't, I mean, and they'll be located in the databases, accepting several prescriptions and going to different pharmacies, for example.
Yep. Through the chair, Representative Wool, that is one of the recognized best practices, and we actually have that in Alaska now.
Okay. I think that was 2 years ago we passed that law, so we're working on the same idea, and so now there is a prescription database.
Yeah.
So that's great. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But if I recall, last year, Representative Keller had a bill, because I think the funding for that was going to expire last August, and I don't believe we passed any legislation to extend the funding. And I think if that when we didn't do that, my understanding was that it was perhaps going to go away, you know. And so during his legislation, we talked a lot about getting that information to providers and who would be responsible for it, and it seemed like the cost became a hindrance. And so, is that inaccurate, or maybe something was resolved that I'm unaware of?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that the funding was eliminated for that program, but the department really felt that it was sufficiently important for the health of Alaska that that activity actually continued.
Okay.
And I think we do it through an agreement with another department, through Commerce and Economic.
Reverend Vasquez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But that's a database just to keep track of who's getting these prescriptions, right? Is that something apart from the lock-in program over utilization of prescription drugs that historically has existed in the department? Yeah.
If I may call to the microphone one of our resident experts in the department to be able to answer that question, Mr. Chairman.
And that'd be fine. And would welcome, and would you put yourself on the record and your position?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Sherwood. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Health and Social Services. And to the Chair, Representative Vasquez, lock-in is separate. Lock-in is a term that's used in the medical assistance program for people who utilization of certain services, primarily emergency room and prescription drugs, exceed certain parameters, statistical parameters, folks will get locked in. That means they have to identify a single primary care physician and a single pharmacy and use those or be referred to other service providers through those. That applies to Medicaid. The prescription database that was being discussed applies across the board to healthcare providers and pharmacies, and is not limited to Medicaid. So those are you could be in lock-in, and providers would still be required to report to the database. So.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up while we have you here. And so the hang-up last year was this information is available in a database, but the provider is the person who has the responsibility of going to the database to get that information, if I'm remembering this correctly. And what we were trying to accomplish was trying to kind of change that burden, or I'm just trying to remember how there seemed to be a problem where the information maybe wasn't getting to the right people at the right time. We didn't have it in real time, so it was on like a 30-day reporting or something like that. Has any of that changed since it was moved to another department, or how that's all being managed now?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, the database is under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and honestly, I can't tell you about those issues.
Okay.
The administration of the database isn't our department's responsibility, and I wouldn't want to speak for another department.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Mr. Chair,
Reverend Vasquez.
Yeah, Mr. Sherwood. So, how is is the prescription database used at all by department personnel? And if so, for what purpose and who?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, my understanding is we do not have access under the statute to the database, but I would want to confirm that to be absolutely certain. It's primarily intended for providers to use in prescribing practices. So,
Mr. Chair?
Follow-up, Representative Vasquez.
So right now, to the best of your knowledge, you're going to confirm with the department personnel have access to that database. Is that because of statutory constraints or just?
Through the chair, that's my understanding, is that the statute does not identify us as a user of the database. But I'd want to confirm that. I just, by way of explanation, until about 2 years ago, I worked with the Division of Healthcare Services and track these kind of issues. But for the last 2 years, I've worked in Senior and Disability Services, and so there may have been changes. I'm just kind of coming back to the broader Medicaid program after a two-year absence, so I want to make sure my data is current.
And if you'd provide that answer to us later, that'd be fine. So thanks.
And also,
Representative Vasquez.
Yeah. I would like to also know how many people we have, individuals, recipients we have in lock-in, and what has been, during the past 5 years, the use of that program to constrain expenses.
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, we can get you that information.
Is that,
Mr. Chair, Representative Vasquez.
Is that settlement that was reached with legal services still in effect with regard to the lock-in program?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, we'll have to get you that information. I'm not aware of the current status.
And possibly what you could do is put us together a little paper of the status and how the program works and just let us know also if there's any glitches or anything that's constraining the system from working. Would that adequately answer the questions that you're...
Yes, Mr. Chair. There's just one more comment. I'd like to see the actual settlement agreement. I know that was years ago that was reached with the legal services, but I think this is a really good cost containment measure because it contains overutilization by recipients. It's abusive. You know, it doesn't really add to good care for the patient.
And thank you. And you can provide that directly, that settlement agreement. The committee doesn't need, but you can provide that directly there.
Thank you.
But we would like kind of an outline of the program. Mm-hmm.
So, thank Mr. you, Chair.
Representative Wolf.
Just to follow up on this database, does it also track the physician as well, i.e. the example that was given earlier about someone with root canal getting a 30-day supply, besides the recipient of the prescription, does it also track the provider to see who's maybe in need of pain management education?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. It's as I said, it's the database is run within another department, and I'm not familiar with quite how it works.
Sure.
And I think you can see that there's a fair amount of interest on both of these things for management. So if you would provide that to the committee, how the program works, what the constraints are, if it also lets the department know which providers may be overutilizing or overprescribing as well, that would be helpful. I don't know if the database is used that way, but that's something that we would like to know.
Yes.
Does anyone else have any other particular questions they want in the response to the database or lock in? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, John.
Seats are a lot more comfortable back
there. Yeah.
So,
and we're back to Dr. Butler.
Yes. So, when we talk about use of substances, we have very soon a new legal substance, marijuana, that we want to be able to reduce any adverse health effects of marijuana legalization. We are working both within the Division of Public Health to determine how we can best address those issues, as well as be able to detect adverse health events so that we can then address those. We want to be able to do what's best for Alaska, but we also know that other states are ahead of us on this, and we want to learn from their lessons. The experience in Colorado has certainly been very instructive in terms of short-term effects of marijuana legalization. Some of them are surprising, some maybe not so much. There has been a big increase in children going to the emergency room for THC toxicity, and this is not teenagers but younger children, because of the products that basically look and taste like regular cookies or gummy worms that sometimes have very high concentrations of THC. And some of these children have been very sick. Fortunately, there have been no deaths. One of the types of things that I would not have anticipated has been the admissions to the burn units from butane burns when it's used as a solvent for extracting THC. Particularly when it's done indoors or in an unventilated place and there's a spark or an open flame nearby. And some conditions that I'm not sure were really in the medical literature until people became more open about talking about their marijuana use or the complications, such as the hyperemesis syndrome, which is basically uncontrollable vomiting, which may seem like an unexpected symptom of marijuana, given that it's an appetite stimulant. It sometimes is used to treat nausea in a number of medical conditions. But this is a pretty horrible condition for people who have it. And so there needs to be outreach to the provider community so that people know how to manage that. We certainly also have concerns about the emerging literature on long-term effects, particularly heavy use in adolescents may be associated with intellectual decline. We also participate in an interdepartmental working group within state government, which will be looking at regulations related to marijuana. The bigger question, of course, when we talk about whatever we're talking about, whether it be opioids, alcohol, marijuana, heroin, which unfortunately the use has gone up. I actually had a patient tell me recently that he could get heroin for less than the price of a pack of cigarettes, is why do people need to self-medicate? And I think there is actually a public health side to some of the questions about how our children are raised, the data on the effects of adverse childhood experiences and how they affect later health in later life is something we're just really beginning to get our heads around, and looking at how we might be able to reduce the effects of children on health for children that have suffered abuse or other types of trauma early in life. Roughly 25% of injuries resulting in hospitalization are associated with alcohol. And it's a good lead-in then to talk about injuries. Injuries are actually the leading cause of premature death in Alaska. We oftentimes think in terms of cancer and heart disease, but in terms of things that take our young people, it's either unintentional injuries or sometimes intentional injuries, such as suicide or homicide. Also, when injuries occur, the outcome may be influenced by what occurs in what's called the golden hour, usually the first hour after the injury occurs, which is associated to that field management, as well as transport to ideally a certified trauma center. We continue to work to build our EMS system and to support particularly rural EMS units, helping persons who are victims of injury trauma across the state. We've also been made progress in terms of certification of our hospitals by the American College of Surgeons as trauma centers. Only a few years ago, we had a very small number, only one level two trauma center in the state. We now have two level two centers, both in Anchorage, but we have, I believe, now some 15 or 16 centers that have at least the level four designation.
Before you on, where we have prevention of injuries, other than the, I mean, it's a big number, 25% are alcohol related, but what other strategies are we looking at for prevention of injuries?
Yeah,
I mean, I heard the management of care, but.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some of the programs that have been successful have been things like the Kids Don't Float program to encourage personal flotation device uses. I have to give a shout out to the White Float Coat program that was supported by AMTHC. These were basically the Mustang coats that are made white, like a traditional whaler's coat. Now, while there's not many drownings that occur among whalers, the whalers are the leaders of the community. Kids see those float coats, and they want to wear them, too. So I think that's one of the driving forces behind some declines in drowning deaths. Seat belts, helmets, a lot of this is education type materials, as well as to some extent regulation, such as fines for not wearing a seat belt. I also need to mention the most tragic type of injury, those associated with domestic and family violence. Not a traditional part of public health, but one that we need to continue to address. And I recognize that there it becomes fairly complicated in terms of the public health model, that we have multiple drivers in terms of historical trauma or early childhood events or experiences that then lead to substance abuse and may ultimately lead to violence, because violence is where a person has grown up and there's an acceptance of certain types of behavior. I don't have the answer for that, but I think we have to start with conversation and recognize that it is a problem. Moving on, immunizations have made a big difference in the health of our kids. We actually do very well in Alaska at vaccinating our school-age children. We do vaccinate our kids. We don't always vaccinate them on time, and you've probably heard some of the statistics in terms of the measure of our two-year-old immunization rates, that we're in the lower third among the states. One of the challenges is just having access to vaccines. Previously, it was very common that children had vaccines made available to them. Alaska was among the states that maintained a universal vaccine program for years. We're using new models and new ways of thinking to return to that. The Alaska Vaccine Assessment Program actually had their first board meeting yesterday. This is an opportunity for providers as well as third-party payers to pool resources and to be able to purchase vaccines off of the wholesale price list, so that it's a substantial savings, particularly to providers. And the third-party payers also see it as a savings. I hope a year from now to be able to come tell you much more about how that model has worked. I think we are the 10th state to use that type of model for vaccine purchases. So, again, we've been able to learn from the experiences as well as the mistakes of others, and our goal is to do it right.
So last year, we passed the so that we were going to have, the state was going to purchase and warehouse and distribute, be the main distributor of vaccines in the state, instead of everybody going out and trying to estimate their supply and bring them in or not. So is that in place this year, and was that, or is that for next year?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Mr. Chairman. This provides the opportunity to make this a sustainable program. The remaining funds from that is part of how we forward funded the first year's vaccine purchases. Going forward, it will be the assessment that continues to support that, and then that will provide the opportunity for us to buy in bulk to have vaccine come into our depot and then distribute it within the state. It's a unique aspect of Alaska. Most of the country now has a direct-to-provider distribution. We've convinced the feds we know more about logistics of medical supplies in an Arctic environment than they do, so they have agreed with the model that we have been using. Moving into preventing infectious diseases, I don't put this on the list just because that's my area of clinical experience. It is one that continues to, I don't think it will ever go away because of all the health threats we deal with. This is the one, other than maybe bear attacks, where we're dealing with another biologic system, and it can change, it can outsmart us. Of course, some bacteria have a lifespan of only 10 minutes, so they can reproduce very rapidly and adapt to the things that we do to prevent them or to treat them. Ebola has been in the headlines. Everybody knows that. I think the risk in Alaska is not high, but it's not zero either. The department has been involved in monitoring returning travelers. We get actually a very small volume of people returning from the Ebola-affected areas. But we basically, those people are identified now because of their entry into the United States is controlled, and then they are contacted daily for monitoring for symptoms. We continue to work with our hospitals, including our partners in Washington State, regarding how we would manage a patient if indeed we were to end up with an Ebola case. There are other things. I think one of the good things about Ebola is it's helped us again think about serious infectious diseases. I think people have already forgotten last May we saw our first case of MERS, or Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. Unlike the situation in Dallas, we did not see subsequent transmission of MERS in the United States, and I think it kind of went out of people's minds. But it's another fairly scary infection, and we have to make sure that we're ready to deal with those things. It's hard to believe that only 2 months ago I was practicing putting on all the suiting and coating my hands with Hershey syrup to see if I could then get out of it without contaminating myself. So there, and the support from the state at that time when I was on the other side of the table was very much appreciated.
Representative Foster.
Amazing. I'd actually left Dallas-Fort Worth about an hour before I think the first Ebola person came to the United States. So, you know, the world is just such a, we travel all like it's nothing now, and so it's amazing on that. My question is, a major contributing factor to infectious diseases is a lack of safe water and sewer, and I know that ADEC releases the funds for Village Safe Water. However, I guess what role does HESS play in that? Is that on your radar?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, one of the things that both Jay and I did in prior lives in a previous position, I got to report it, but I think Jay and company actually did it. The Centers for Disease Control and ANTHC, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, actually looked at the question of what is the impact on infants and communities without adequate sanitation facilities. And they did a study on the YK region, the region that I'm from, and found that infants and communities without adequate sanitation facilities are 11 times more likely to be hospitalized for respiratory infections and 5 times more likely to be hospitalized for skin infections. And to be clear, those aren't just babies that are getting sick. Those are babies that are sick enough that they have to be medevaced out of the community and end up in the hospital. And effectively, what that means also is that 1 out of every 3 infants in that year, in that community, can expect to be hospitalized that year. And so we can certainly raise the public health awareness of that. The challenge is, how do we make sure that programs that we know will see a huge public health benefit for our state continue when they're in another department and in a time where we have significant budget contractions that are happening in our state? I want to tell you about the experience of one child that I know who had RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus. I never really pronounced that right, but anyway, it's RSV. And we see a huge spike in RSV every year, especially in February. And this little girl was 8 months old, ended up in the hospital, and was in the hospital for 10 days, maybe 9 days, had the little oxygen coming from her nose, and her crib was in an oxygen tank, in an oxygen tent. And so double dose of oxygen. But that child will forever have a compromised respiratory system. There's a high correlation between infants who have RSV and asthma. So this little girl was at one time on 5 different kinds of medications to keep her from getting sick and was in the hospital with pneumonia every single year until she was 7 years old. And so you add up the costs of the care of providing for that one child, they're pretty significant. And the reason I know so much about that child is that was my daughter when I was living in Bethel. She is now 11, thank goodness, and has not been in the hospital since she was 7. And we hope that will continue. And ironically, I was traveling in Washington, D.C., advocating for adequate sanitation facilities. Those programs get matched from a variety of sources, including USDA funds, and EPA funds, as well as state a 25% match required by the state, which get funded through the Department of Environmental Conservation. So there is definitely a link between adequate sanitation facilities and public health and the health status in communities.
Mr. Chairman, if I can add, obviously that's a question Representative Foster that both Commissioner and I get excited about. As we look across rural Alaska and the remaining 20% of the population that doesn't have access to sanitation services, I think we have to look at what can we realistically do also, because as we get down into the smaller and smaller villages, it does become more and more expensive to provide the type of running water and flush toilets that we might that we do enjoy in Juneau or Anchorage. So looking at both the health status as well as other engineering models for providing those services is important. One of the things that's interesting about the study that the commissioner was referencing is the diseases that were associated with lack of running water are the ones we would call wash water diseases. They weren't waterborne diseases as such. So that suggests that one of the challenges is just being able to do basic personal hygiene in terms of washing and then also getting rid of the honey bucket to a great degree also. So we're certainly interested in some of the work that's emerging in the tribal health system to be able to look at how to capture surface water or melted snow or rain to be able to provide an adequate supply of wash water. Our surveys of water usage in the villages with minimal access to running water suggest that the water that's used is very similar to what's the absolute minimum in the WHO standards for refugee camps. So we have to do better in terms of providing opportunities for people to be able to wash in parts of rural Alaska.
Thank you.
I got that look from the commissioner. I know what that means. So. I also wanted to talk about preventing infant deaths. 50 years ago, about 1 in 40 Alaskan infants didn't see their first birthday. In western parts of Alaska, it was 5% died in the first year of life. Today, those rates are some tenfold lower. And I think this is one of the success stories. Initially, much of that change was through immunization, particularly addressing the measles and whooping cough epidemics that occurred through the 60s. But also, as we were actually just talking, in terms of improving standards of living. And actually now our infant death rate is 15% lower than the national mean, and we're 15th among all the states in terms of the lowest infant mortality rates. That said, it's not as low as it needs to be, and we need to continue to push forward in terms of how we protect our children in the first year of life so that they can grow up to be healthier adults. Finally, I wanted to mention, well, it's not really finally because there's a couple other things I want to say with the commissioner and the chairman's permission, but I wanted to speak to implementation of Healthy Alaskans 2020 Action Plan. And I'd be happy to talk with anyone further about Healthy Alaskans 2020, but I think it begins to get at the issue of how do we programmatically begin to address some of these health challenges and make a difference. Healthy Alaskans was a collaboration of the state of Alaska with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium to really connect with communities around the state to identify what are some of the priorities for improving health and what we might do to be able to make those improvements, specifically for conditions where we can measure the impact and know that we're being efficient and making a difference. The outcome of that was 25 measures. So you may have heard of Healthy People 2020, which is a federal goal that I think has 500 and some goals. You know, we tried to keep it very focused. Our documents don't make good doorstops, but I think they're very usable. And the goals that have been defined includes very specific health outcomes such as reducing cancer mortality, reducing our suicide rate, to also some fairly big picture issues such as improving our high school graduation rate, because in general people with higher education attainment do have better health, and reducing the proportion of Alaskans that live below the poverty line. If I could, two final comments before I turn it back over to the commissioner. I'm very pleased to hear the interest in prevention, even though my training and background seems very clinically oriented, and I'll be the first to tell you that what we call health care is really disease care. I became very interested in prevention because of my interest in infectious diseases. And the first patient I ever had died of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. I learned a lot from that gentleman in the 6 hours I knew him. Obviously, we received him when he was very sick. But it started my interest in prevention about how people could avoid exposure to the sources of these type of serious infections. Thanks to the opportunity to be in this role in the past in this state, I've become much more of a generalist and think much more broadly in terms of prevention. I'm very pleased to say that prevention is also a emphasis of the Alaska Healthcare Commission as well, and making sure that we're thinking in terms of prevention, in terms of how we provide health care. Given the opening comments, I feel like I have to comment on vitamin D, since sounds like there's a common interest there. It's an area that's very exciting in terms of what's out there. There are literally thousands of studies now associating low levels of vitamin D with a number of health outcomes. The most robust are related to prevention of falls and fractures in the elderly, but there are large number of other health outcomes such as cancer, particularly cancer of the colon, the breast, the prostate, cardiovascular disease, stroke, diabetes, affective disorders such as depression that have been associated with low levels of vitamin D. As I once said at one time I was governor of the American College of Physicians chapter in Alaska, and at their national meeting we had a move to encourage the FDA to be more active in addressing the role of vitamin D in health, and I spoke to the group on behalf of all of us from cold, dark states. There are still a lot of questions, I will say, that in terms of the public health opportunity. I have as many questions as answers, but you know, as a clinician, certainly I was very familiar with the data on vitamin D status and progression of liver fibrosis. So in my patients with chronic hepatitis, I usually checked a vitamin D level and treated with vitamin D as needed. We talked about, you know, association doesn't necessarily prove causation, and that we were treating a lab value as much as anything. But I did use vitamin D as a clinician, and during the winter months, I take a little vitamin D myself. I think in terms of we're going to be learning much more. I shared with Representative Seaton, we just went on clinicaltrials.gov and found, was kind of dizzied by over 1,500 registered clinical trials assessing vitamin D. I'm a bit of a pragmatist in terms of what does this mean for us as we look at the population of Alaska. The one that intrigued me most is called the VITAL trial. It involves some 25,000 Americans, and it has all the magic words that the FDA likes to hear for vaccine trials or prescription drug trials in terms of it being randomized, double-blind control, which basically means no one knows who's taking what till the code is broken. But with that thousands of people, it's looking primarily at prevention of cancer, cardiovascular disease. But because it's such a large study, there's also nested analyses built into it to be able to assess things like cognitive decline in the elderly, as well as impact on infectious diseases. And certainly there's data that points to things like prevention of some respiratory tract infections. There's even a randomized trial in children. I'll be the first to tell you it's not perfect, but it shows lower rates of influenza in those who received vitamin D. I'm sort of a veteran of the flu wars, and boy, if we could prevent flu with something as easy as an over-the-counter nutritional supplement, that would be fantastic if we could show that, because as this year has proven to us, our 50-year-old technology for flu vaccines is not perfect if it doesn't match the strain that's circulating. Or as our experience with the last pandemic showed us, it takes a lot of time to produce a flu vaccine with the current technology. So this is an area that's of great interest to me, and I know, Mr. Chairman, we'll talk further about exchanging papers, but I appreciate the ones that you have been forwarding to me.
And I appreciate that, too, and I just want to say that, you know, one thing that we've just learned really within the last 6 months is that a number of trials that were null trials didn't show anything, were actually giving a once-a-month dosage or once-a-week dosage, and now that we know that it's the actual vitamin D3 that one's taking, half-life of 24 hours in the body, if you have a once-monthly dosage, no doctor would tell somebody to take their cholesterol medicine once a month or drink all their glasses of water once a month or do any of those things. And it turns out that what we're measuring as far as circulating D isn't what's active for the soft tissue. So I was really happy to hear that the Mayo Clinic is doing a huge trial on looking at cancer. And then I went through the design, and unfortunately, they are giving once a month maintenance dose, and which means that for all the soft tissue deals, right, cancer, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you give a large dose or a smaller dose, if it's only there for 3 days out of the month, it's not going to probably show us much. So I hopefully, as we go forward, we'll look at studies that are designed in a way that will look at the soft tissues, which are really what we're doing. So I'm sure we'll have these conversations more fully later, but I appreciate your openness to looking at things as well. So we're about out of time, but we have time to wrap up. And Commissioner?
So the last thing I wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, is that I also wanted to acknowledge the work that was done by the Health and Social Services Transition Team. Governor Walker assembled over 250 Alaskans to bring forward ideas for how to improve our state in the delivery of services for every department. I wanted to extend my appreciation to Jeff Cook from Fairbanks, who chaired the Health and Social Services Transition Team over a course of the weekend. These are their top five recommendations. I'm not going to go into more detail. We will be evaluating these. Those reports are available on Governor Walker's website. And I would encourage everyone to take a look at those. We will be certainly evaluating those recommendations and seeing which ones that we are able to implement within the department. And with that, I just wanted to say, Koyana Chaknak, thank you so much for the opportunity and for being such a friendly committee for which to do my very first presentation as commissioner. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, we thank you for your participation, and I don't want to get out of here without at least putting out to the public and to everyone in the department that Medicaid expansion is something that we're really looking at hard. I want to make sure that as we go forward, we look at the two criteria that was Arizona's criteria that says that here's the deal, but it won't be backsliding if you, the federal government, reduce your reimbursement rate below what you've promised, and so we could get out of the deal if they did reduce those rates. And the other thing was looking at the Tennessee model for having the people that are going to benefit, not the individual Alaskans, but the people that are going to get the compensation, pick up part of the tab for implementing the program. That's the Tennessee model, where the hospitals across the state have come forward and said that, hey, if we get reimbursed, right now we're providing charity care, if we get reimbursed, we're willing to pay the 10% and carry that load of Medicaid expansion because they're getting paid instead of not paid. But the state doesn't get paid. So those that are going to benefit from compensation could actually be contributing to the funding the expansion. So I look forward to your consideration of that and the whole department's in this conversation. And with that, we're out of time, and so we'll adjourn, and thank you again.
Thank you.